welcome you all again to the second session and the final session of the Legacy of Friedrich von Hayek, a conference sponsored by the Committee on Social Thought in honor of our former colleague, unpaid former colleague, we learned yesterday, and the Liberty Fund of Indianapolis, Indiana. I think those of you who were here yesterday know that we've already learned an enormous amount about Hayek, the relations of his various works to each other, and especially with Professor Leube's speech, its relation to the history of Austrian theory about economics. Today promises to be just as interesting and informative about Hayek and his legacy. Our first speaker is Professor Kenneth Minogue, who is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the London School of Economics and Senior Research Fellow with the Social Affairs Unit in London. He has published widely on an incredible range of topics: the rhetoric of political discourse, the doctrine of political parties and their relation to the political traditions of the West, feminism, Marxism, and other ideologies, Britain and the European Union, nationalism, and several influential pieces on the history of political theory. He is the author of The Liberal Mind, 1963, Nationalism, 1967, The Concept of a University, 1974, Alien Powers, The Pure Theory of Ideology, 1985, and Politics, A Very Short Introduction, 1995. Professor Minogue has lectured at major universities and research centers worldwide, as currently a director of the Center for Policy Studies, for which he has written two studies, The Egalitarian Conceit and the Constitutional Mania, and is this year, or half this year, this quarter, a research fellow at the Liberty Fund in Indianapolis. It's a great pleasure to welcome him to Chicago, and I'm very interested in hearing the talk, given the scope of the title, Hayek and the Fate of Liberty in the 20th Century. Professor Minogue.
Thank you very much, Robert. Yes, it's a somewhat overblown title, and I think I probably have reason to repent me of it. It will come up, but I sort of moved on to various other things. The problem is that I have a vast admiration for Hayek, a great interest in his legacy. I have no doubt that he's one of the great men of the 20th century. But I have some difficulty quite in getting onto his wavelength, as will appear. I think there are some problems that require looking into there, and some of these will appear as we go on. What I first want to do is to make some remarks about his first book, The Road to Serfdom, and that will involve the fate of freedom. And I then want to go on to analyze the rhetoric of that argument in terms of the idea of a slippery slope, of a trend statement about how things are going. And then I want to end with considering some of the moral problems that Hayek himself, I think, was always galloping up to, but never actually galloping into. The Road to Serfdom was a book that caused enormous trouble, particularly to Hayek himself, and it also managed to offend very large numbers of people who thought he was pretty much off the wall. I mean, in the context of 1944, and given that his image of totalitarianism was largely Nazi Germany, because he didn't want to talk too much about our Russian allies at that time, The Road to Serfdom cashed out as the conclusion that the Beveridge Plan, which was, everybody thought, a relatively harmless way of dealing with the problems of unemployment, would end in concentration camps. And this was regarded as really off the map of any sort of sane political argument at all. It would lead to complete determination of society. Now, this is a time when everybody was talking about post-war reconstruction, when a lot of academics had gone into ministries and were helping the government, when common sense said to people with memories of unemployment and the Depression, look, it's obvious that if you have 4 or 5 million people in Britain, in this case, unemployed, and obviously a lot of people's needs not being satisfied, surely the government can do something about that. The problem is how to put them to work and allow them to satisfy obvious needs. So that Hayek's work appeared to be profoundly counterintuitive, and I think that's one of the main things that that is important about it. That indeed, I shall be arguing, is one of the main reasons why he's going to be a very important figure even into the 21st century, because what he says cuts against what is pretty obvious to most people. In 1944, many people agreed with Hayek that central planning of the communist sort wouldn't work. But nonetheless, they thought that he had gone over the top in presenting this slippery slope argument. His friend Lionel Robbins thought it was alarmist. Paul Samuelson said quite simply it was wrong. Keynes agreed with Winston Churchill, whom Hayek on one occasion met. Hayek commented that Churchill appeared to have been having quite a number of brandies before they ever spoke, but what Churchill said to him, according to his account, was, "You're absolutely right, but it won't happen here." Perhaps the most far-reaching position was that of Raymond Aron, who simply denied that Hayek could possibly have said anything so absurd in the first place. In a 1979 essay, one supporter of Hayek thought that Hayek had in fact got it right and said, "Beneath the hollow forms of constitutional government grows an increasingly powerful state, manipulating democracy to serve its own ends." This doesn't seem to me to be a particularly outrageous remark, but it provoked in a recent pamphlet published earlier this year the comment, "This comes close to the paranoid rhetoric of the wildest American dissidents." So it's obvious that even two generations later, Hayek can be wiped right off the political map. I might say en passant, as it were, that one of the great tendencies of Blairite Britain, and I think Mr. Clinton is following it, is the attempt to command the centre and to push everybody else to the extreme. So the distinction between what is sane and what is ultra or extreme is becoming in practice quite an important one. So Hayek can still be wiped off the political maps. Hayek's response to this was one of reculer pour mieux sauter. "Of course," he wrote in the 70s, "6 years of socialist government in England have not produced anything resembling a totalitarian state." But then he went on to argue that his point had been that government control produces changes in the psychology of the people. And he added, "The important point is that the political ideals of a people and its attitude towards authority are as much the effect as the cause of the political institutions under which it lives." And that, I suppose, is a direct reply to Keynes and Churchill, both of whom said, "The British, because of a long tradition of liberty, can get away with things that other people cannot get away with." And I think on this, as I think on many of the other things, I think Hayek is perfectly right. This was in the mid-70s, and Hayek agreed that the process could be averted, the process of sliding down towards totalitarianism, it could be averted by a reassertion of the spirit of freedom. But at that time, he saw no sign that this was happening in England. It did, of course, in a sense, happen in 1979, and in many countries in the Western world in the 1980s, which privatized what had been nationalized, adopted policies of low inflation, and began encouraging the enterprise which previously they had been taxing and regulating out of existence. But the electoral force of this resulted less from a renewed understanding of freedom than from the recognition that existing mixed economies were actually impoverishing the people. The spirit, one might say, had been saved by the belly, and that, I think, is the basic comment I want to make about the fate of freedom in the 20th century. But if you look to the wider spheres of civic life, such as the universities, the spirit of enterprise at that time was hardly to be glimpsed. One wouldn't, of course, want, in response to the problems of that time, which were not, certainly in retrospect, all that severe. One wouldn't want a Patrick Henry crying, "Give me liberty or give me death." And I suppose the contrast with the USSR was sufficiently strong for people to think, well, we do know what servitude and serfdom really are like. They are the Soviet Union, and certainly we are not anything remotely like that. And yet, in the 70s and indeed later, the universities had lost all spirit of their specialness, all sense that a university was a separate thing with rather different interests from the state itself. Dons at that time, and I think later, were crying out to become useful tools of some national strategy. They wanted to be instruments of the government. And the ethics of political correctness, which is a form of right thinking, were already beginning to affect life. Again, the compassion of inclusiveness, letting everyone into everything, whether they had the qualifications for it or not, was trumping the severe conditionalities of freedom. So it seems to me that in the 1970s, there were clear signs that what Hayek had been talking about was beginning to come about. Again, of course, the people in the 70s are different from the people in the 50s, and they're different from us in the 90s. And therefore, one's sense of what is different is determined by what one has got used to. But all of this is by way of suggesting that Hayek was by no means wrong in suggesting this kind of slippery slope argument. And it's to that that I want to turn. And one of the great conveniences of a slippery slope argument, I suppose, is that you can always adjust the level of the slope. Some slopes are catastrophic and people go down the very fast, while some slopes are rather slow, and the prophet, the person who predicts some bad thing along these lines, can say, well, it's happening, but it hasn't quite happened yet. So what I suppose a slippery slope argument means is a denial of the sovereignty of will in politics. I mean, the opposite view would be that if the government decides that an intervention in the economy, say a direction of labour or something of that sort, is necessary, it can do this. And if it then decides that the consequences are unfortunate, it can then change its tack. What the slippery slope argument says is that once you embark upon this thing, there are reasons and forces which will lead to a continuation of just that policy, and the continuation will go on, unless something fairly dramatic happens, until you find yourself in a rather different situation altogether. So I now want to examine this form of rhetoric and see if it sheds any light upon what Hayek is talking about. A slippery slope is a version of a trend or process used for persuasive purposes and characterized by something desirable at the beginning and something hopelessly undesirable at the end. These slopes are formal devices like cycles for exhibiting structural relationships, and in politics, Machiavelli is a notable master of both. Perhaps the purest example of a slippery slope is the administrator who refuses some perfectly sensible request by on the grounds that it would be a precedent leading to a whole series of procedures he cannot control. The aphorism that hard cases make bad law is an implicit slippery slope argument. Rhetorically, the slippery slope arguments are an element in the understanding of illusion in politics, a much wider subject, because it's invoked by those who point to a feature of reality which, so it's claimed, others have failed to understand. The element of illusion is an important feature in the Hayekian slope, because politicians are liable to be seduced by the obvious short-term advantages of exploiting the power of government to make some economic equation come out right without understanding the longer-term consequences of the move. A central feature of politics is that what an event is depends to a fairly considerable extent on how it's described, and the supporters of some policy which its opponents think dangerous in the long term will clearly describe it in a way that obscures its dangerous potential. So that what we have here is a partisan, abstract, but extremely fertile metaphor for discussing political moves. It's a useful via negativa of policy discussion because it blocks initiatives and it's thought to be a virtuoso speciality of conservative politics. That's certainly how Francis Cornford took it in his marvellous piece of whimsy about political skill, the Microcosmographica Academica. Hayek's use of the device might thus be seen as one more way in which he might be corralled, kicking and screaming, into the camp of conservatives. But I think that whole understanding of slippery slopes is wrong, because they're often used by radicals. For example, if there's censorship or crackdown by governments, the slippery slope argument often takes the form of today it's us, but tomorrow it will be you. There are a variety of ways in which these slopes can prove slippery. In the case of the cautious bureaucrat who doesn't want to accede to a request because of the precedent it will create, it's logical consistency. In granting one thing, he will have to grant others. Many slopes involve causal chains, such as the cobweb theorem in economics or appeasement in international relations. Sometimes a slide is attributed to the development of a cast of mind, which goes on reproducing itself. Many slippery slopes are self-reinforcing and have a built-in tendency to accelerate. Thus, as more and more women go out to work, they increase the supply of labour, whose price consequently falls, with the result that one wage becomes less capable of supporting a family, which in turn forces more women out to work, which in turn, and so on. The slippery slope is thus the metaphor underlying all forms of declinism. It's, as I say, an abstract description of processes which always have many other features, some of which may well run in the contrary direction. There are progressive upward slopes as well as degenerative downward ones. Sometimes they're wrapped up together. And this means that their significance depends in part on how they're described. And there is a danger, as Hayek himself recognized, that something new and valuable may be misunderstood as a form of decline when it's not. In the 16th century, for example, the emergence of individualism was often seen as a decline in the way in which people were behaving, a collapse of social order, whereas in fact it was the emergence of something quite new. The fall of man, again, is theologically a disaster, but it's possible to understand it as a fortunate fall which gives birth to the moral life. Now, these considerations indicate that the slippery slope is strictly a practical device and that it depends on fixed and static valuations. It can be countered by anyone who sees supposedly undesirable conditions at the bottom of the slope in a different light. And for the philosopher, these slopes are excessively abstract and formal. And what basically concerns such a philosopher is not the dangers, because no philosopher is concerned with practice in that way, but whether some new kind of experience is emerging. And that's the sort of challenge that could be made, and indeed I think is made, to Hayek. The suggestion that what he sees at the bottom of this slope as totalitarianism might simply be a new kind of society altogether. Perhaps the telos of welfareism is a poor but gentler society. Now I want to move on to three slopes that might illustrate how this thing works. And the general suggestion I want to make is that Hayek's slope is a special case of a more general kind of phenomenon in modern societies. The first we may call the Hayekian slope because it's the one in The Road to Serfdom itself and in other writings. The background is the propensity of electorates in democracies to demand that governments should solve problems, a propensity which of course fits very snugly into the actual inclination of governments themselves, which seek to extend the scope and exercise of their power. The illusion involved in this particular case is that pragmatic responses to problems will be limited to solving that particular problem. The illusion is that the government can always change its mind and go into reverse if it chooses to do so. The reality, however, is that this kind of governmental fix is addictive. Many people come to believe that governments plus scientific research can solve almost any kind of social problem. Political solutions to economic problems, however, not only enfeeble the spontaneous resources of society, but of course they create further problems. And then the same solution, further government intervention, beckons. For example, when a group becomes privileged as a result of political influence rather than economic performance, others will clamour for the same benefit. In a democracy, this is hard to resist. Distortions will accumulate. The process is all the more dangerous, as later writers such as James Buchanan and Mansur Olson have brought out, in that the benefits are for the most part electorally conspicuous, while the costs long remain hidden in the mysteries of regulation or general taxation. And Hayek has, of course, the supplementary argument that in this process, the worst people will tend to come out on top. Indeed, evidence suggests that even a partial reversal of this kind of process, as the Thatcher episode in Britain showed, will be pretty close to politically traumatic. The British welfare state is indeed quite a good example of this, because it was set up basically between 45 and 51 and sustained by Conservative governments after that. They grumbled, but they didn't actually try to put it into reverse. But then the rate of growth of the British economy began slowing down. One of the reasons why the British decided that perhaps they ought to join the European Community. And then one Conservative government, elected in 1970 on a program designed to revive economic enterprise, was put into reverse in 1972 in the famous thing known in Britain as the U-turn. The economy turned down and the government turned back. Crises continued throughout the 1970s. Political scientists began arguing that Britain, as an advanced modern economy, was becoming ungovernable because the scope of government was spreading into trade unions, into all sorts of areas of society, and paradoxically, the more it spread, the less effective it seemed to be, so that there was a thesis about ungovernability. The British had the immense fortune of a complete and almost total breakdown in 1978-79 in what was known as the Winter of Discontent, with a lot of public service strikes. And the result was that Margaret Thatcher, who was certainly not then a popular figure, I'm not sure she is now, was elected to power. And this particular Hayekian slope was, up to a point, reversed. Did this experience confirm or refute the Hayek thesis? Well, like everything else in this area, the question might be argued either way. But there's no doubt, I think, that the Hayekian thesis does illuminate the self-intensifying character of the process of governmental intervention. But as I have remarked, freedom here was saved not by the courage of those who loved freedom, but by the accident that interventionism was destroying prosperity. This raises the possibility that if socialists could find a way of perfecting society according to their lights, in a way compatible with an expanding GNP, or perhaps merely one that didn't actually shrink, then they might at least avoid the Hayekian check. Let me now turn to another slope, which I shall call the Oakeshott slope, and which I have with immensely brutal surgery extracted from the some essays by Michael Oakeshott called Rationalism in Politics. At the top of this particular slope, we find a tradition or a practice, an inherited tradition of behavior, which we might exemplify by teaching, school teaching, for example. This is a tradition which can be analyzed in terms of the knowledge of which it's constituted. Practical knowledge is part of it. A bit of it is propositional knowledge, but that's only a relatively small bit of it. Rationalist beliefs appear, rationalism surfaces, when the activity comes to be codified as functional to some wider social concern. The result is that it is stripped down to what it is supposed to produce. It may be a new idea about child development, may be a belief about the cause of some social pathology. For example, how schools contribute to violence in society, or a project to make children more critical and questioning. Many are the forms of restiveness that will begin to buffet a tradition and subject to a theory, turning it eventually into an ideology. A focused plan of improvement replaces the many-faceted complex of the tradition itself. But then no plan can do what a tradition does, because traditions communicate vastly more than can be formulated in a codification. Pupils traditionally pick up both pieties and sensibilities from a genuine teacher, and these are things which plans can hardly even comprehend. On this particular point, Hayek and Oakeshott are certainly agreed, both rejecting the substitution of policy for tradition. The slope appears then when the limits of rationalist abstraction are revealed in practical deficiencies. The point is that the way to deal with a failing plan is, of course, another plan, imagined to be a better plan. But this idea, too, being a plan, will be abstract. It cannot but distort the implicit rhythms of the tradition, and it will, in turn, by its partiality, create further problems. As Oakeshott remarked, the unfortunate rationalist can never get back to a solid diet of experience. Everything he touches turns into a problem and a plan and a proposal. If this sounds a little formal, it may again be illustrated in terms of recent experience, British experience, but replicated, I think, everywhere else. In the British case, the theory focused on traditional education as being mechanical, restrictive, socially divisive. I suppose in America the corresponding thing would be racially divisive, and unrelated to the real interests of the child. A focus on spontaneity led to a revulsion against, and I will never forget whoever invented this expression, rote learning, mere mechanical rote learning. The many ideas involved in this complex of thoughts dominated teaching from the 1960s onwards. They were thus implicated in the degenerating literacy and numeracy exhibited by British pupils over the last couple of decades. A reforming government in 1998 commanded schools to devote 1 hour a day to improving literacy and 1 hour a day to improving numeracy. Very traditional, one might say, except, of course, that it's still a plan, and it's rigid, and it has brought the commands of government into schools, an area which was previously left free. This is all part of the slope. Rationalism is what happens when a tradition is understood in terms of that small, conscious, and deliberate part of it which can be put into words and codified. It's the basic shape of governmental and bureaucratic slippery slopes, because the instinctive response to a failure of regulation is to think that there hasn't been enough of it. It derives from a command cast of mind in which new roles will always be found for obsolescent agencies, and reinventions happen regularly in a protean world where distraction of mind is the rule. The juices of life are turned into the dust of codification. What is depressing about this particular slope is that there is no direct way up again. A sort of brisk Thatcherite reversal is just not possible with that kind of corruption. Thirdly, let's consider something that I shall call a liberation slope. It hasn't hitherto been explored in quite these terms, but it underlies a great deal of moral and social comment on our society. Here again, the beginning is some inherited tradition which is being subject to criticism as, in some sense, usually utilitarian, irrational. Sexual liberation is a large and complex area in which this progress might be seen at work. Sexual desire has always been encased in a great variety of religious and moral rules, which sought to control at least the public expression of sexual appetite before and outside marriage. Utilitarian criticism suggested that most of this, especially given the advances in sexual technology, was a pointless frustration, standing as a barrier to natural fulfillment, a barrier perhaps even to human rights. The word spread that these old-fashioned prohibitions dated from unenlightened times, and we embarked during the century on our present liberated condition. The long-term effect was that the many individual miseries of earlier times were swapped for the things we now recognize as social problems. I mean, I tend to believe that the human condition is pretty much static in terms of piety, happiness, folly, and so on. And therefore, I'm not for a moment suggesting that this particular slope is creating more misery than in the past. It may indeed be creating a certain amount less, but you simply swap one problem or set of problems for another. So we got, instead of individual miseries, we got social problems. The rise in venereal diseases, teenage pregnancy, AIDS, rising divorce, abortion rates, breakdown of family life, and the rest. Now, on all such questions, and this is where the point of freedom lies, governments began to develop problems and intrude into social and indeed individual life. Condoms were promoted, sex education increased, disincentives to teenage pregnancy explored, divorce law changed, etc. The liberation slope is then one in which a population or elements within it throw off some conventional restraint understood as irrational and frustrating, and embrace a more direct satisfaction of desires. Sex and money are especially areas which attract this kind of liberation. Good examples are to be found in the welfare state. The populations of rich Western states are liberated by the creation of governmental pensions and subsidized health from the necessity for prudence about rainy days. Plastic banking further liberates people from the necessity even of having to wait to get the things they desire. A population thus liberated loses the self-discipline that was necessary in earlier times, and that leads on to further social problems, the debt syndrome and so on. And these things called social problems are the food on which governments feed. Here are the slopes that, if we constitute them as slopes at all, certainly take a generation or two to work themselves out. But the general rule would seem to be that liberation in one generation is followed by regulation and often repression a generation or two later. One thinks of women throwing off the conventions which restricted them smoking in public from the 20s on, and then a generation or two later we find smoking itself, for a variety of reasons, under severe kinds of attack. In universities, government liberation from the payment of fees led to a vast expansion of universities. Within a generation in some countries, governments had taken extensive powers to turn independent academic institutions into instruments of a national strategy for improving the GNP. So now let's attempt to generalize what I've been talking about. In all of these cases, I argue, freedom is lost, and the end of the process is, one might plausibly say, some form of what Hayek called serfdom. The serfdom or servitude is constituted by the steady transfer of initiative and control from individuals towards governments. This is evident in the case of the Hayek slope. One aspect of the Oakeshott slope is to make clear the role of experts who have a special place in all of this. And with the liberation slope, servitude will be evident in the repression emerging as the social costs of liberation become evident. At a more profound level, human beings become servile as they lose their identity and become pure pursuers of satisfaction, a point I'll briefly consider in the next section. Is there then, we may ask, some general principle which links all of these slopes together? There are, I think, several candidates, and they complement one another. Consider the case of price control in the Hayekian slope. Prices are the result of many complex factors, which means not only that they often seem too high, but that they are also unstable. Governments step in and stabilize them at a level that purchasers will approve. In terms of what most people want, at least in the short term, price control is an improvement. And as is often the case, politics is here an instrument of wish fulfillment, of the pleasure principle. While economics is the dismal call of reality. But there is, of course, an underlying illusion involved. People think, or thinking in a democratic way, that they have gained the power to control something in their world. As individuals, however, participating in the market they have lost, they have lost the more direct power of influencing price and consumption. As this process develops, they increasingly get less of what they want rather than more. So here we have a particular illusion, the illusion of greater control, the movement from individual to democratic power. In the Oakeshott case, we begin with a concrete activity which is only loosely purposive, if it's purposive at all. And we streamline it by specifying a set of procedures which will make it achieve more efficiently some purpose formulated into the theory in which the tradition has been turned. We become, in some sense, more active, conscious, and deliberate as we go down this particular slope because we have stripped off things construed as irrelevant. We're streamlined. Similarly, on the liberation slope, we discard rules and practices which are vulnerable to utilitarian canons of criticism, yet which play an important part in the creative development of tradition. To summarize, the move is from a complex, rather diffuse activity conducted in terms of conventions to a simplified and focused activity now conducted according to codified rules which determine a formulated purpose. What before was concrete has become abstract. The relation between complex and concrete, between abstract and concrete in this particular case is complex and possibly needs to be attended to, given that Hayek always argued that freedom means living under abstract rules. When people live under abstract rules, they are in a sense concrete because they are formulating their own plans, policies, and proposals. When these abstract rules are replaced by a government with a substantive policy of its own, then the government has, as it were, absorbed some of the concreteness that belonged in the society, and the individuals who are following through this particular line are, I think, made rather more abstract. So we're dealing with the simplifying force of utilitarianism, or the more general thing these days commonly called instrumentalism. Human complexity has been stripped down to a single criterion of efficiency. In achieving some desired end, an appropriate policy, now commonly elevated to a strategy, this is the contemporary word, for doing this begins to replace the tradition itself. The active individual on the slope, animated either by his own impulse or responding to government policy, has reduced all other considerations, rituals, libations to the gods, inherited formulations of politeness, even the more creative ways of wasting time, to the status of irrelevancies. To act is less and less encumbered by conventions whose point now seems obscure and is more and more subject to social, legal, and political conditions which governments can justify and promote to their populations. It's a movement from moral to formal regulation. Now, this may well seem to make perfect sense. Is it not rational to pursue our ends more efficiently? Is it not very largely what we mean, in fact, by progress? The question that my argument raises is how such forms of conduct should involve a slippery slope to unfreedom. The answer must clearly revolve around what is lost in the process of stripping traditions and practices down to their efficient components. An important part of the answer lies in the logical point that instrumentalist ways of thought tend to turn their exponents into the tools of some wider project. The more a person becomes the pure pursuer of a satisfaction, the more plausible it becomes to say that the desire controls him as much as he controls the desire, because there's less of him there. And in the longer run, each simplification removes initiative from the individual and hands it over to governments, into whose projects the individual has become incorporated. In losing his autonomy, for example, the teacher becomes less the vehicle of a tradition than the instrument of a state policy. But there is, I think, a deeper reason why this process leads to unfreedom. What happens to people when elements of their conduct, construed as merely irrational, have been lopped off? The significance of these practices is that many of them concern the personal and the occupational identity of the individuals involved. By identity here, I mean firstly a recognition inherited from the past of what a person is, and secondly a determination to live one's life as a certain sort of person. Such conditions are usually negative. They involve the sort of awareness that Hegel calls self-related negativity. To be free, indeed, to be a person at all, requires an identity which can be the bearer of that freedom. The point is, I suppose, most easily exemplified in the laws of particular religions, which forbid certain conduct, for example, dietary laws, as a condition of being a participant in the faith. Similarly, moral conduct is the rejection of identities such as that of thief or liar. Manners, again, restrict a further set of impulses, and in this way, personal identity emerges as a sensibility through which a complex individual identity responds to the world. Now, much of what is shaved off as merely traditional is a component of such a moral identity. Without it, a person becomes a little closer to being the bundle of impulses which is to be recognized as an organic, non-moral, and therefore unfree condition. The caution and pomposity of the lawyer, the reserve of the teacher or ruler, not to mention the inhibitions involved in such roles as lady, husband, wife, spinster, etc., are all elements of a thickly textured identity. The point can, I think, be made in a number of ways, and it's a complex point. And it perhaps isn't as clear today as it might have been in the past, partly because the very word identity itself has become a kind of plaything which people can toss up and suggest in a superficial kind of way is a thing of will, something that we can make up as we go along, as the current phrase has it, we reinvent ourselves. So the character of these servitude slopes is that satisfaction is being traded off against identity. At its extreme case, moral integrity melts before desire, and moral integrity is, I think, the thing that's important here and clearly important for freedom. An unfree world is one where everything is for sale. A wife will sleep with a rich man for $1 million, and the lover of a princess will tell his story if the price is right. Integrity is a vital constituent of the inner aspect of freedom, which requires a set of people who cannot be induced to betray themselves. The slippery slope to servitude, then, is a slide to what we might call pure rational agency, a form of thinking that can only accommodate integrity if it is reduced to a preference or a side constraint. Let me now move on to Hayek and the moral question that these considerations raise. Hayek's master idea, I think, was perfectly right. There is a slippery slope which results when governments step in to abort those complex and uncomfortable processes generated by the catalactics of free exchange. Structural unemployment, technical obsolescence, competition from abroad, these are simply the most conspicuous examples of problems that incite governments to move in and fix things. In that way, inhibiting and to some extent over time destroying the active capacity of populations themselves. The basic slope, as Hayek recognized, results from the discovery in a democracy that governments have the power in the short run to solve the pains which one group or another inevitably suffers as dynamic economies explore their potentialities. Governments could not resist the demands of lobbyists and special interest groups and would become increasingly inclined to short-term solutions, involving the curious paradox that governments would become weaker because more easily bent to the will of others and stronger in the sense of extending their range at the same time. But the question becomes, why does Hayek object to this kind of thing happening? Is it solicitude for the free identity of the citizens? This is certainly something of importance to him, though he's curiously incapable of giving much account of this area of experience. He prefers the high ground of generality to trying to analyze what the actual psychology and experience of this thing would be like. The main argument advanced is that socialist measures, being based upon ignorance of economic and social conditions, will impede the production of what is needed. Just as the extended order, his term, of course, for a modern kind of society, just as the extended order alone has facilitated the immense growth of population in the modern world, resulting in all the desirable things which Hayek refers to as civilization, so the slide into socialism will cut off these efficiencies and ultimately be fatal to millions of our fellow human beings. In our present prosperous mixed economies, this sounds like the same kind of melodrama as that evoked by Hayek's original invocation of serfdom. Yet we might well consider that there is inductive evidence for it. The collapse of the communist world after 1989, as it has been put, vindicated Hayek's life work. Further vindications are not far to seek. A dramatic example at the moment is the condition of North Korea at the end of the century. Here is a state which invokes the slippery slope argument in the reverse direction. It is a command economy which will have no truck with any form of exchange on the ground that such a move would be a slippery slope leading to the end of Communist Party control. As a result, many members of its population have been reduced to death and starvation. We in the West certainly have not been so reduced. We wallow in abundance. The question thus becomes, on what ground does Hayek disagree with the socialists? The obvious answer might well be that the disagreement is merely about means. Socialists want to command prosperity and distribute it according to some rational principle, while Hayek tells them that this just cannot be done. The situation is similar to the famous story of the origins of laissez-faire, in which Louis XIV's Colbert called the merchants of Paris together and asked them how the state could help them increase the prosperity of France. Rather horrified at this offer of help from a source that every merchant knew in his bones was big trouble, they found a spokesman in one of their number who growled, "Laissez-nous faire." This became an expression that recognized that even in the most regulated absolute state, there were some areas that prospered better by being left alone. In this classic sense of laissez-faire, the individuals are being left alone not because, according to the doctrines of classic liberalism, this is believed to be essential to their character as free beings, but because they make better instruments that way. Hayek knew this, but I don't think he was very good at formulating it. The broader question is how we make sense of Hayek as a traditionalist who takes freedom to have emerged from custom and tradition against the call of tribal instinct on the one hand and the seductions of an instrumentalist account of reason on the other. He recognizes the content of morality. It consists in such things as family cohesion, respect for property, truth-telling, keeping promises and contracts, and similar familiar virtues, largely promoted, as he is clear, by local religions. He does not give any very useful account of these virtues, many of them highly artificial in Hume's sense, about how they came about. In a broad sense, he thinks these Western virtues leading to the market clearly had survival value as against, perhaps, say, the despotic practices of the Islamic world. But this would not have seemed so obvious 1,000 years ago, and it might turn out to be implausible in the centuries to come. Hume, of course, was well aware of the problem of artificial virtues, and he conjectured that one necessity, namely defence, led to the lateral discovery of such a thing as the advantages of justice. Hayek merely invokes religion as the irrational source of rules. He thinks you cross your fingers and with a bit of luck, people will follow these traditions that have survival value. History becomes merely a process of cultural evolution in which those rules which promote prosperity exhibit their survival value. The problem is that this discussion remains imprisoned in the instrumental question of what form of life most facilitates prosperity, population, and civilization. What is it, we must ask, that makes such rules as, and he cites them, honesty is the best policy, actually moral? The very formulation, in fact, denies its moral basis. In Hayek, everything seems to depend on leaving people alone to follow their own projects. But what is that everything? He tells us that, and I quote, we assign responsibility to the individual in order to influence his acts, end of quote. Is moral responsibility then merely a device for social control? Peace, freedom, and justice are alike merely, he says, three great negatives. No doubt there's much truth in this, but morality cannot really be understood unless these negatives have something of a positive side. Moral responsibility is the individual pursuing his projects in obedience to the abstract rules of morality and law. But Hayek can give no account of quite why we should treat this channeling of individual human endeavour as being morally superior to the collective endeavours which, as he rightly believes, are merely vastly less efficient. Indeed, it's striking that even when he tries to show what's involved in the servitude of those increasingly subject to collective control, he has recourse to the formulations of others, such as Tocqueville or somebody called L.J. Barnes. Now, it might be that Hayek's position is simply that of a moral skeptic, that he really has no theory of what makes freedom morally superior to anything else, except that it opens up a whole variety of possibilities which socialism would foreclose. We recognize, on this view, free enterprise as both more efficient and as being morally superior. We cannot really give much account of why it's morally superior to fitting into some pattern of obedience, but we do know that socialism is a program of dogmatism which forecloses other possible forms of human life, and openness is better than closure. This is, I think, the skeptical defense that Hayek might well make. He might simply avoid the whole issue that I am putting forward, the whole question of what is it that makes a free life morally superior to any other kind of life. Well, it sustains the possibilities of future development. The problem lies in the very difficult question of how you can sustain morality anyway. I mean, in most civilizations, what we regard as moral is virtually exhausted in terms of religion and custom. It is a characteristic, I think, of almost unique to the modern West, that something we can call a moral world has abstracted itself out from these other rules of behavior, and we attempt to find a rational foundation for this. It may be possible or it may not. I mean, most attempts either move in a Kantian direction in which they're subject to the charge of dogmatism. They don't really touch experience, or else they are attempts to rise up from utilitarianism and happiness to genuinely moral rules. But this is a kind of Scylla and Charybdis which make it extremely difficult to give any account of what makes morality rational in any case. So in suggesting that Hayek doesn't give a satisfactory answer to this question, I'm not in the least trying to say that it is an easy, or in some respects even an obvious question to ask. Nonetheless, it seems to me that we can at least make some moves in this direction, and I'd like to end by suggesting them. What's obviously lacking in Hayek's account of morality is that any concern with how the moral agent actually construes his situation. In a traditional society, Confucian or Hindu or something of that sort, self-approval comes in conforming to the role to which one has been called. And the cause of shame is a desire, or worse, an action, in conflict with that ideal role. A Western society, our own society, by contrast, sketches in the social roles that people must play with a relatively light touch. Individuals, to some extent, compose the scripts of their own lives, improvising along with others doing exactly the same thing. Morality, Oakeshott once wrote, is an adverbial qualification arising in the relations between people. Or as indeed Charles Taylor, in a book called Sources of the Self, discovered a clergyman in Massachusetts in the 17th century who had an even brisker formulation of this point by saying, "God loveth adverbs." So morality consists, as it were, in complying with certain admirations of this kind. Western morality thus characteristically operates in terms of two dimensions, a prudential dimension concerned with success and a moral dimension concerned, you might say, with playing the game of life in an acceptable way. This latter dimension will not, of course, generate any fixed set of moral rules. And one of the important points about morality that Hayek does make, he makes it in connection with his criticism of central planning, but he says that the assumption of the central planner is that moral systems are fixed and complete, whereas he points out that no moral system is fixed and complete. They're always evolving and facing new problems and new definitions of their terms and so on. Indeed, all moralities do contain internal tensions and contradictions, and moral admirations adumbrate ideals in tension with each other. Revealing the misdeeds of others may be a citizenly duty, but it will be singing like a canary in the code of omerta. In these moral terms, then, life is a game in which we are tested in terms of our capacity to face up to stress and temptation. And just such a view of the moral life derives ultimately, of course, from the Christian tradition in Paul and Augustine, notably within the competitive structures of our economic and moral life. The point is, I think, central to the viability of Hayekian liberalism, because ultimately it's only in moral terms that liberalism can be distinguished from socialism, mercantilism, and other forms of constructive rationalism which spring from the mind of man almost daily. Socialist projects involve, I think, two central premises, and it's only their incompatibility which has so far saved us from sliding further than we have. The first is that the point of human life is that it consists in the satisfaction of a stream of desires. The bad thing is frustration. The second is that true humanity consists in living in a harmonious, conflictless community. These two requirements, that is, satisfaction of desires and harmony of society, jointly entail the view that the single basis of social life must be cooperation, and communist societies are the attempt to generate everything out of the process of cooperation without competition. Socialists want the economy to be a vast productive machine powered by human cooperation and leading to the equitable distribution of its fruits. The check to socialism in our century has been the fact that the machine won't produce enough of the goods unless competition is given free rein. And socialists can barely distinguish competition from conflict. And conflict, of course, involves disharmony, and disharmony is a social problem contrary to the basic premises of the project. At this expedient level, it will be recognized that pure cooperation cannot produce everything. But a time might come when many people could be persuaded that it could produce enough, and then the socialist program could be implemented without too much attention to the Hayekian check. In the conception of human life held by classical liberals, and of course here I'm using liberalism in this classical sense, not at all the American sense of liberalism. In this conception of human life, the good consists in responding to one's situation with courage, fortitude, responsibility, and other qualities whose status as virtues does not have to be related to social utility. So understood, freedom can be detached from what has been most dangerous to it in this century, namely its presumed indispensability to prosperity. No doubt prosperity has been useful in its contemporary survival, but prosperity is ultimately subversive of freedom itself, because unless competition is recognized as having a moral as well as an instrumental value, it will be forever vulnerable to contingent changes of attitude. I do not think it can be claimed that Hayek was, in his later years, actually thinking along the moral lines that I have adumbrated. But there are signs that he would have been open to it. They consist in the notes he added to his last book, The Fatal Conceit. One of them, a slightly confused recognition of the importance of religion, and the other, a reference to Huizinga's book Homo Ludens. These provoked a rap over the knuckles by one of his more ardent admirers, Knud Harkinson, but they point, I think, in the direction that I'm indicating. My conclusion must be, however, that Hayek never quite clarified his confusion on these matters. One reason is that while the whole of his philosophy was a powerful recognition of the fact that policy must take its bearings from what we inherit, he had a remarkable aversion to being regarded as a conservative. He identified conservatism with timidity and lack of courage. Burke may have been one of his heroes, but Burke had first to be boxed in as a traditional Whig. Given how contrary to his philosophy is to radicalism, this aversion must be seen, I think, partly as basically tactical. Defending his view that guided progress would not be progress, Hayek counterattacks, and I quote his words, and they tell you a lot, I think, about the way in which he regarded conservatism. He says, "I can already hear our modern intellectuals hurling against such an emphasis on tradition their deadly thunderbolt of conservative thinking." Well, deadly is as deadly suffers. Hayek wanted to belong to the progressive gang. And indeed, there are some ways in which I think he was naturally progressive. In the Constitution of Liberty, which people were agreeing yesterday is his masterpiece, he has some wise words to say about the importance of the idle rich and people of independent means and so on. And I think that's all perfectly right. But then he suddenly moves on and says, if our society had not inherited a collection of people with independent means, it might be quite a good idea randomly to select one person in 1,000 who would be given the status of independent means in order to create this kind of tradition. Well, of course, you don't get things in this mechanical, smart kind of way. Or you might say, of course, that we actually have that system in the form of lotteries and forms of gambling, but it clearly has no relation whatever to what he's very sensibly talking about. So there is a remarkable parallel between Hayek's philosophy and the fate of freedom in the 20th century, and it's not entirely to the credit of either. Hayek understood that socialism impoverishes and taught us that free markets make us prosperous, which they do. But that hardly touches the moral issue, the issue of how we sustain the identity of the West, which at a deeper level from which all of this comes. Similarly, in the 1970s, experience taught many people that Hayek was right. Socialism actually was ruining our prosperity. As a result, socialism went into reverse and everybody adopted the free market, even communists. But this did not stop the march of servility. Governments merely learned to leave the economy alone for the moment, and they have since turned to the equally fascinating business of attitudinal and social engineering. They've moved to society out of the economy. Western governments these days have national strategies for helping us do just about everything we might think of doing. Sport, medicine, health, racial relations, sexual life, art, etc. There is no end to benign governments helping to solve our problems with a bit of subsidy here, a regulation there. And yet we don't feel any more controlled than we were before. The reason, I think, is that morality is disappearing into a kind of socialization. The ultimate conclusion of my argument, then, is in principle a gloomy one. The West has discovered that stripping off the clutter of identity we inherited from our ancestors and becoming more purposive about pursuing our satisfactions yields, generation by generation, enormous dividends of efficiency. This has certainly created a marvelous technology to service our desires, but it is steadily reducing individuals to a manageable assemblage of impulses in pursuit of satisfactions. Perhaps, in other words, the whole of modern history has been, as older people often think, a slippery slope in which we have traded down material success against the identities that once made us what we were. But then this, like most slippery slope arguments, is overdrawn. What is more likely happening is that we are creating a new kind of human being who fits into a new kind of social life. But it is not one in which freedom will be particularly prominent.
Thank you very much. We have time for some questions before we have our break. Yes, Gary.
Very interesting lecture. I had one question about the slippery slope. I don't think you developed sufficiently. I don't think Hayek developed sufficiently, but I'm not enough of an expert on Hayek or your writings to know for certain. There certainly is elements of a slippery slope in any series of interventions, and you've seen that in economic policy and other areas. But there's also a major counter force that operates, that sort of flattens out the slope and maybe even shifts it to a hill rather than a slope. And you can see that in two of your examples, I think. You said, I wrote it down, tried to quote actually, that the accident, interventionism was destroying the economy in the 70s and so on, that led to this reaction for privatization and so on. Of course, the economists would say, and Hayek would say, and did say, it wasn't an accident. This was an inevitable process of having an interventionist economy that would be much less efficient and so on. The next step would be to go on to say, as a result of that, there would be a reaction in the political process against the set of policies that we had. And we've seen that in starting in Great Britain with the privatization and now throughout the world and communism and the like. That's one example. The second one you mentioned was schools. Now, lots of bad things have gone on in the public school system in the United States and Britain and many other countries. But in the United States, and I think in many countries of the world, you're seeing a similar reaction now. An unhappiness on the part of parents with a sort of education or indoctrination that their children are getting. And they're looking for greater control, alternatives, and the like. So we have the charter school movement in the United States, more competition in the school system. The voucher movement, I believe, has essentially won the fight in the United States, although not yet won the political process, but I think it essentially won the fight. And this is going on in other countries of the world. So there was a slippery slope, but the slope, I think, has been stopped, and I believe it will be reversed in the school system, and it was reversed in the economy. And that's a force, I think, that has to be integrated into a fuller analysis of a slippery slope, whether it's moral or economic issues that are involved. So I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
Yes, I think you're right. In the sense that the slippery slope is essentially a device for discussing practical policy terms, and furthermore, it's a one-dimensional one. That is to say, the first example that you were talking about is that government intervention will lead to a decline in economic efficiency. That says nothing about the political reaction, or indeed perhaps the psychological reactions that people might have. So that it's always... The trouble with metaphors is that the temptation to mix them is terrible. I'm almost inclined to say it's always possible to have a deus ex machina who will muck up the slope. And this is the kind of thing that happened, of course, in the Thatcher case, where something from outside the terms of the slope will be able to prevent it. I suppose that's always possible. I mean, the point about slippery slopes is that they are less predictive devices than warning devices. That is, their point is to put before people what is presumed to be a form of illusion in order to get them to do something about it. Now, with regard to the teaching case, I think we have a different situation. At least we have a different situation if you take Oakeshott's argument as having a real force. When he originally put it forward in the late 40s, people said, what can we do about it? You know, if you're right that rationalism in politics is this process by which complex traditions are codified, become barren, become thinner, and also become unsuccessful, what are we going to do about it? Now, the very question itself is, as it were, part of this slope. His point is that once the practice of thinking of in terms of problems, solutions, codifications, and so on, has become entrenched, then the almost instinctive and almost irresistible way of responding to it is to say, we need a better plan, we need a better thing to do. Now, you know, I agree with you. I think I'm a great supporter of vouchers. I think that getting the central direction out of education is the first step in releasing it from the various codifications which have been so disastrous to it in the last two or three decades. And I think that if that happened, then that sort of transmissibility of traditional capacities, the fact that teaching, for example, isn't an isolated bit of tradition, but also draws upon other activities like parenting and so on, that transmissibility will begin to restore what has been a torn fabric of tradition. So, you know, I think that there are possible ways in which you can go back up that particular slope.
Yeah. It's taking this argument that Hayek made about the economy and turning it, as he attempts to do, toward morality, and completing the set by reproaching governments for regulating moral behavior, which he does in the Constitution of Liberty. He says that governments really ought not to regulate relations between adults, the institution of marriage, say. That, it seems to me, is where the argument, in a sense, runs off the rails. That is, the reason governments regulate marriage is not because they think they can plan who ought to be with who, but precisely because governments embody communal traditions that have learned to protect the institution of marriage. So that in transferring the argument to the moral realm, as I seem to have attempted to, did he not fly in the face or undermine the basis upon which society does the very thing you say needs to be done, which is to honor its traditions and respect them?
Yes, I don't know about honoring traditions or respecting them. It's sort of living them that is the key point. And I wouldn't be altogether sure that governments are the custodians of these communal traditions. I mean, no doubt sometimes they are, and in some respects they are. But governments also, of course, have their own interests. They are subject particularly to expert advice. They set up royal commissions on all sorts of moral issues, issues of divorce, issue of the relation between science and ethics and things of that sort. And in all of these cases, they're also subject to lobbying and so on. So my instinct there would simply be to agree with Hayek that the more people are left free to make their own responses, the better. No doubt there are in practice some limits to that. But I think the central argument really is that governments moving in to solve these problems enfeebles the capacities of a society to respond in its own way. I think that there is there a theory of the active potentiality of society as being capable of responding to almost anything by a set of variety of individual responses rather than a government plan which enforces one particular response. So on that, I think I'm clearly on Hayek's side.
Yes.
Ask you this. Is it maybe a little bit unfair in a way to suggest that Hayek sort of falls down because he doesn't sort of resolve the moral issue? Because it's like, okay, everyone could agree that no one would like to live in North Korea, whereas
yes,
modern
yes.
Britain, there's things that about modern Britain we might not like. And that Hayek doesn't tell us what the sort of ideal Hayekian personality or group of personalities would be or what type of human being we'd like to have. We know some kind of free-acting person who lives as some kind of free moral agent, lives in that fashion. But you could do that to some extent in Britain. Can we say that just by him being prescient about the failures of a very dogmatic and heavy-handed socialism and communism, he's made enough of a contribution to look elsewhere for the sort of, who's the moral actor and what's he supposed to look like?
Oh, right, yes. Well, if you're saying he's done enough, you know, he's done his bit and it's up to us to carry on, well, that's fine. I think you're perfectly right. But it is, one of the ways in which intellectuals operate. He's a social philosopher. He calls himself a social philosopher. And what social philosophers want is people to say, yes, fine, you haven't always thought of this, that, or the other, to continue his work. In other words, criticism is exactly what the average philosopher, I won't say always welcomes, but what they ought to get and inform. If you say, what do you want? They will say, I want a critical response. They may get very irritated with it. Well, I'm giving him a critical response. I can go one stage further with this and say that one of the problems I had reading Hayek, always have had reading Hayek, is that I think his one central idea is absolutely marvelous and casts a lot of light on all sorts of things. But then he comes to a point, sometimes a moral or psychological point, and he simply stops. And I'm slightly disconcerted by this. That is, I think that there are ways in which his thought can be pushed further. And this is a sort of slightly ham-fisted attempt to do that.
Point. So since I have a microphone on, I'll simply interview.
Well, you've got power.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yes. I thought what you were doing in setting Hayek's project in this kind of larger context was extremely illuminating, but I found your response more, perhaps even more pessimistic than you indicated it was. I mean, I took your main point to be that it's not unimaginable that there could be conditions under which intervention and regulation, because of some unique geographical or economic historical condition, actually produce a sufficient level of prosperity to be quite tolerable politically for
yes.
quite a long period of time, or there might be traditional or psychological conditions under which the decline in prosperity might be acceptable for various reasons other than issues of prosperity, and that Hayek hadn't paid enough attention in a way to how the value or the use critically of prosperity might be in some sense qualified by these other conditions,
yeah.
on the one hand. On the other hand, you suggest that the real sort of question for Hayek and for views like his is where does the moral rejection of mere prosperity at the price of something valuable like individual, where does that come from? Here comes your sort of Oakeshottian side, that there are these traditional inheritances that might help explain the customs out of which morality is built or lives. But then you seem to suggest that something in the general fabric of modern societies is reducing the role of tradition and custom, so that we end up with bundles of preferences, anomic, without connections to long. So the one thing that might help us answer the Hayekian problem, your view seems to be, is less and less on the horizon as a source of moral outrage or moral rejection.
Yes, I suppose the Hayekian problem that I was talking about is an intellectual problem in the first instance. And when, if you were to solve that, it would be an explanation of why socialism is a bad thing, free enterprise is a good thing, in a way which would not be subject and not be a hostage, as it were, to these contingent changes of prosperity. I don't quite see, I mean, I think that the problems of a free enterprise society are partly that Hayek did not supply that, and possibly it may, as I suggested, not be capable of being supplied. But the problems are also that the slippery slope argument that he presented can in fact be extended. I think there are other slopes in which the threat to a free enterprise society is to be found. In other words, the best I can do in answering your question is to say that what you've pointed to is a theoretical problem and a practical problem of free enterprise. And what I've tried to do is present Hayek as deficient in one, in the theoretical way of supporting free enterprise, and possibly all too prescient in explaining the practical difficulties.
Yes.
Aren't those of us who value freedom, economic freedom, and other forms of freedom, at a terrible disadvantage because we seem to be disinclined, my goodness, to the kind of propaganda and demagoguery that statists seem to be so good at utilizing? I think there's a problem there.
I think there's a problem there too. We have a slightly baffled sense of the unfairness of things, don't we? That we won the Cold War, and look, the socialist and collectivist tendencies are still going on. I think that's true. The problem is in part that political activism only has one outlet into these collectivist and journalistic enterprises that I suppose you were referring to, whereas the initiative of free people has a million outlets. And therefore, while in one sense the struts of our free society are constantly being gnawed away by the kind of thing that you're talking about, there are other elements of the free society which are reconstituting themselves simply because of the vitality of a sufficient number of free individuals, such as Hayek studied and such as he thought were extremely valuable. So I think there's a balance here.
In your presentation, there's a linkage of what I would call a positive side. Slippery slope is a positive side. If we start on a course of policy, like government regulation, doesn't continue until it begins to encompass the economy. And a normative side of, what type of society should we be looking for? Now, I think I was trying to address the positive side, and I've always looked at the road to serfdom as a trap.
Yes.
It was not a careful analysis of the slippery slope. It was was advocated, a call to arms, so to speak, that this is a terrible situation, we have to really organize ourselves. And it was a great achievement because it did alert many people to it. But it did not provide a clear analysis of, as we move along the direction of governmental extension, will there be forces set up as a result maybe of what happens in the economy, but not only in the economy, what happens in the school system, what happens in other dimensions, that there will be a reaction, particularly in a democratic society, against this, and will halt and maybe begin to reverse somewhat. I think we've seen that process at work in the economic sphere. I don't think it's an accident. I think there are real reasons why that it was happening there. Well, we'll see it equally well in some of these other social dimensions that you were stressing, which I think are very serious, remains to be seen, but it isn't obvious we won't be seeing it in those areas as well.
Yes, you're being optimistic about this. You think that...
I didn't answer the question, and I don't feel your discussion answered.
Yes, I think the road to serfdom may be a tract. Subsequent works were an attempt to elaborate that tract. Hayek described himself as a social philosopher, and he believed that one of the contrasts was between being a social philosopher, which meant to him that you understood the long-term implications of things by contrast with pragmatism and blundering from one thing to the next. Now, it is, I think, one of the limitations of the slippery slope as an argument, but it's one I think that Hayek was aware of, that if it's operating over several generations, you have to recognize that the people who are there at the beginning generation are different from the people who are there at the later stages of the slope. I think Walter Badgett once remarked that you can never judge the effect of any reform in the generation of the people who introduced the reform, because it's only when people are responding to that reform that you can see what effect it will have. You can often have reforms which work perfectly well for at least a generation because of the character of the people at the time of the reform. Now, I think that point is quite important with Hayek, and when he says that the social attitudes of people are the result as well as the cause of what governments do, he's making, I think, a very important point, and that is that things change with every generation. See, one of the puzzles of this whole freedom business is that there is an argument for saying we are less free today than we were 50 or 100 years ago. And at the same time, you can also plausibly say we are more free than we were. And we are, I think, in our everyday lives, more conscious of the ways in which we are more free than the ways in which we are less free. That itself, of course, may be a sinister fact of life. It may result from the fact that government regulation and the things that make us unfree are carefully tailored to our own impulses and our own dislike of frustrations and so on, as to be less visible in the short term than they would otherwise be. But I think, these are elements in what you might call the complex theory of freedom, and it is very difficult indeed. And all you can say of Hayek is that he illuminated quite a large area here. But of course, nobody illuminates the lot.